This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. I'm going to tell you of some new research. You tell me what you make of it. In one study, children as young as age 7 estimated that African Americans experienced less pain when exposed to the same injury as whites. Would your guess be that these children are racist? Now, consider that previous research with adults shows the same result. Are all these grown-ups racist too? What if you knew that people of all races, including African Americans themselves, guessed that blacks were less likely to feel pain than whites? Might it cause you to rethink some things about race and prejudice? We've got three social scientists with us who've been doing these landmark studies, and I suspect you will start seeing some of the complexities of prejudice quite differently if you stay tuned for what they have to say right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. One basic question for you this hour. What kind of attitudes do you have toward people whose skin color is different than your own? If you've got an answer, our phone lines are open at 888-WMRA-TALK. If you say that skin color does not matter, that you have no difference of attitude based on race, I've got these follow-ups. Is it possible that you might have some beliefs buried so deep that you're not even aware of them? And if that is possible, how would anyone uncover those buried beliefs? In all numbers, we are at 888-967-2825. Three social scientists who've been doing some intriguing investigations into these issues are with us. Social psychology researcher and doctoral candidate at the University of Virginia, Rebecca Dorr. Social psychology researcher and doctoral candidate at the University of Virginia, Kelly Marie Hoffman. Plus, faculty member in the Department of Psychology at UVA, Sophie Trewalter. Thank you all for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Well, Dr. Trewalter, you first, if I may. I understand that you had an experience at the age of 10 that may well be connected to how you ended up doing the kind of research that you've been doing for quite some time now. So I'm curious, could you tell us the story of what happened at age 10?
Of course. So I was born and raised in the northeastern corner of France on the border of Germany and Switzerland. I lived in a really small village of 900 people, and it was not a very diverse village. We were mostly almost exclusively white. We were mostly almost exclusively Catholic.
Do I understand that the one element of diversity in that little town was that there was one Protestant family?
We had one Protestant family, and we thought they were very weird. And so when my family moved to the United States when I was 10, we moved to Charlotte, North Carolina. The diversity in the airport alone was really exciting for me. I thought it was just beautiful to see all of these different people, and very quickly realized that even though my initial reaction was to be very excited about this newfound diversity, that most people in the United States are perhaps not that excited about diversity and racial diversity in particular, and that for a 10-year-old was a real puzzle, and it stayed with me for a long time until now and beyond. But even in high school, I remember writing peace, love, and happiness poems and anti-racism poems. And so it was always one of my goals to contribute to our understanding of racial disparities and racial bias.
So when you first came to the U.S., I understand that it was because your father had a job transfer mm-hmm. that brought him. And you came to a southern state. You came to southern North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And what was this, like the late 1980s?
Yes.
Okay. So it was well after the era of segregation
it was.
In the South. But I'm curious, because you have lived and worked in many places around the U.S. since then. Have you noticed much difference as you go around the U.S. between what you originally found in North Carolina, this puzzlement that other people didn't see diversity as the beautiful thing that you did? Or is it pretty much the same?
That's a great question. I mean, I should mention, we moved to Charlotte, North Carolina at the time in the late 80s and early 90s. Charlotte was and is still a segregated city. And I remember this was still in the time when the city had instituted busing so that the schools could be better integrated, because although, of course, segregation was no longer a law, it was still very much fact. And so even as a fifth and sixth grader, I remember taking hour-long bus rides to school because there was this policy in place to try to integrate the schools. So obviously race and racial segregation in Charlotte at that time was still very much an issue. And since then, I've lived in a number of places, including New Hampshire, Vermont, Chicago, and Illinois, and now Virginia. And there's no doubt that race is an issue in all of those places. It has different tones and undertones, but for sure, race is an issue.
So ever since your college days, and certainly in your doctoral dissertation, much of your focus as a social psychologist has been on things related to prejudice and mm-hmm. racial bias. And you, over the past few years, have done some fascinating work trying to measure how people view other people's experience of pain and yes. how that may or may not relate to racial bias. So yes. tell us about those experiments.
Yeah, so let me just provide a little bit of context. In the United States, we know that there are some pretty glaring racial disparities in health, and that those in part stem from pretty glaring racial disparities in healthcare. One of the more striking disparities in healthcare is a racial disparity in pain meds and pain meds allocation. So, for example, we know from a lot of research that Black patients are less likely to get pain meds when they need them. And when they do get them, they get less of them relative to white patients. Now, the, I think, less charitable attribution for that discrepancy is that doctors are recognizing the pain of Black patients, but they're not then giving the pain meds. They're withholding pain meds. And there's some evidence that that might be part of the problem. I think our research suggests, and at least wanted to test, the alternative possibility that another potential source of the problem is that doctors and people more generally don't recognize the pain of Black patients to begin with. And that, of course, is also a problem, but it's a very different kind of problem. And so in a number of studies, what we've done very simply is ask people to rate the pain they think either a Black person or a white person would feel in a number of scenarios. So
do I understand all of these studies involve people of all races?
Yes. So, yeah, and that is one of the more surprising findings in this research that we've been doing. And to be honest, it wasn't a priori what we had predicted. But yes, that's right. So we have in our samples in these studies people from various ethnic racial groups. And so what we ask them is to consider how much pain either a Black person or a white person would feel under various situations. So, for example, slamming your hand in a car door. And what we find very reliably is that people will say that a Black person would feel less pain than a white person.
And
in
you,
such
you set
scenarios.
This up in these experiments where you show pictures?
We show pictures. Mm-hmm. So we show pictures. We say, this is Jordan. Meet Jordan. Jordan is 24 years old. And we then say, estimate the amount of pain you think Jordan would feel if he slammed his hand in a car door, if he got a paper cut, if he slammed his head on a shelf, what are other items, Kelly?
Got sunburn and someone touched him on that spot.
Oh, yeah, that's bad. Yeah. And so what people will say is that.
And they can tell what race the person is simply
from the
by
picture.
Looking at the
right.
picture.
Yeah. And we don't call attention to the race of the person in the picture, but we know from other research that people notice race very reliably, very quickly, and that it's surely something that they pick up in those scenarios.
And so the results of the study are what were you finding when people were estimating from those different kinds of injuries how much pain the person who's African-American in the picture versus the person who's white in the picture would be experiencing?
So we find, again, very reliably that across racial ethnic groups that people assume that the Black person would feel less pain than the white person.
Right. And importantly, we've also found this in a sample with medical personnel. So one of the goals, as Sophie mentioned, in the context of these studies was to determine whether another factor that might contribute to racial disparities in pain treatment might be this bias in pain perception of Black versus white people. And so we conducted a very similar study examining whether medical personnel, nursing students and nurses, show this racial bias in pain perception. And we found, again, that consistent with our previous studies, that they rated the pain of a Black person as significantly less than a white person.
And Kelly Hoffman, do I understand correctly that included among the groups of people who are rating African-Americans' pain less are African-Americans themselves?
Correct. So as Sophie had mentioned, we have participants of all racial and ethnic groups, so Black, white, Hispanic, Asian. And importantly, we've also measured racial attitudes, because one of the first assumptions that people might make for a racial bias is that it might be related to racial attitudes. And so we used a number of different measures. Some of them were self-report measures of how much how people feel towards different groups, including Blacks and whites.
So that's what you social psychologists call an explicit
measure?
That's
an explicit measure, correct. So participants are able to self-report this on a scale. We also use more covert measures, what we call implicit measures. And so these are reaction time-based tasks that get at people's associations between white and Black people and good and bad things. And so we've done these measures and we've correlated them with our measure of pain perception. We found across numerous samples, again, that these racial attitudes didn't seem to correlate with the bias. So it's not the case from our data that people who hold more negative racial attitudes toward Black people think that Black people feel less pain. In fact,
so let me make sure I've got this right. Mm-hmm. If in this implicit measurement that you're taking that really gets to my underlying prejudices or lack thereof, you're finding that I really have no different attitudes towards whites or blacks, that I'm just as positive towards both. But you're also finding that I am more likely to rate a white person as feeling more pain than a Black person.
Yeah. So,
did I say that right?
Well, for implicit attitudes, we do reliably find a preference for white people over Black people. So over 70% of Americans hold some racial implicit attitude that favors whites over Blacks. And so we find that, but what it doesn't do is it doesn't relate to the bias. So people can range and have either higher or lower implicit prejudice. However, that is not related to whether they think a Black person feels less pain than a white person.
Okay, so if there's no relationship between my level of bias mm-hmm. and the degree to which I rate white people feeling more pain than Black people, or if I'm African American myself mm-hmm. and I say that Black people don't feel pain as easily as white people, then what is going on?
So that's a great question. And we have been examining this in follow-up work. In particular, we are looking at these lay theories that people seem to have about toughness and hardship. So kind of this notion that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, that enduring hardship and toughness or hardship in your life leads you to be tougher and thus less susceptible to pain. And so we've examined the extent to which people endorse these beliefs. And we've asked people in a very similar study to our original paradigm, where we first say, here's a picture of Jordan, who's either Black or white, and then how much pain does Jordan feel across these various scenarios? And then we ask them to rate how hard Jordan's life has been. So how much adversity do you think Jordan has experienced? And what we find is that people, on average, perceive the Black target as having a harder life, and that the extent to which they perceive this person as having a harder life, they think they feel less pain. So these perceptions of hardship matter.
And I think another way to say this is that people who have very positive racial attitudes also show the bias. And it's not because they're lying to us about their racial attitudes, but it's because they believe in this cultural narrative that we have, that people who have endured hardship are tougher and therefore feel less pain. And it's a very kind of, it's a lovely notion insofar as we think that people don't feel more pain than they can endure. Right. So it's one that makes us feel less bad about thinking that people have felt a lot of pain.
So it seems like I'm going to have to ask you more about that. We also have not yet heard the voice of Rebecca Dorr, who's been doing some fascinating investigations into children's attitudes. And hey, you there on the other side of your radio, we want to know what you think of what you've been hearing so far and what you think of the complexity of racial attitudes in our world. We'll give you the phone number in just a moment. From the psychology department at the University of Virginia, Professor Sophie Trewalter is one of our guests. Here with her, two social psychology researchers who are both doctoral candidates at UVA, Kelly Hoffman and Rebecca Dorr. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. Okay, Rebecca Dorr, what have you been finding out about kids?
Right. So based on these findings that Sophie and Kelly have with adults, we were really interested in seeing when this bias might come in childhood. So when does this develop? When do children start to show this bias? So we had groups of 5, 7, and 10-year-olds come in to the lab, and they did a task that was very similar to the task that they've done with adults. So they rated both their own pain on different items, as well as the pain of a Black child and the pain of a white child. And children are using these sort of smiley face scales to respond. So a child smiling for no pain to a child crying for a lot of pain. What we find is that we don't see evidence of the bias at age 5. Children at that age aren't differentiating between the pain of the Black and the white child, but that by age 7, we're starting to see the bias, and that it's pretty solid and reliable by age 10. So by age 10, particularly these children are reporting that the pain of the Black child is less than the pain of the white child.
Yeah, one thing I find so striking about these data is not just how early this bias emerges, but the fact that many of these parents are very surprised to learn or would be very surprised to learn that their child would show this bias, in part because a lot of the parents tell us that they don't talk about race to their child. So how could their child possibly show this bias? I think what it tells us is that kids are very savvy. They make observations about the world that they're in. They clearly notice race. They notice race very early, actually much earlier than even age 5. But by the age of 10, they understand that there's this cultural narrative, perhaps, where people who have harder lives are thought to feel less pain. And so I find it fascinating that kids at age 10 already understand that narrative and can report that a Black child might feel less pain than a white child.
I should note that in addition to our phone number, if you prefer to type instead of talk and you've got a question or comment for our guests, you can post on our Facebook page where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we got this post from Sarah shortly before we began our discussion today. She asks here, is there any research that shows what causes some children to have less prejudice or bias than others?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think
this is Rebecca.
Sorry, with this bias particularly, we don't have that data yet. We don't know specifically what the mechanism is with this racial bias in pain perception in childhood, at least. There is this data to suggest that in adulthood, it seems to be about hardship. We're currently collecting some data to look at whether that might be the mechanism in childhood as well. Right now, what we have is this age difference. We know that in childhood, this is something that seems to develop across middle to late childhood, but we don't know exactly what it's related to. What we do know is that it doesn't seem to be related to negative racial attitudes. So we have data in this initial study looking at children's, what we call children's social preference, so who they say they'd rather be friends with. Would they rather be friends with a white child or a Black child? And the extent to which children say they'd rather be friends with white children than Black children is not related to this racial bias in pain perception, but we don't know what else it might be related to at this point.
Let's go next to Winchester. Jason, thanks for calling us here on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please, for Rebecca Dorr, Kelly Hoffman, or Sophie Trewalter.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on and for actually this topic. I think it's very crucial that we look more closely at all of our biases and how they're formed. But with the emphasis on the aspect of hardship in the perspective that we have towards other people, I really wonder if we're not maybe looking past the fundamental issue as being one of class. And I understand that race has a lot to do with the way that we perceive our class relationships with one another. But I wonder, because I easily imagine you finding that people people think that poor people don't feel pain as much as someone who's more comfortable. And that also may have a lot, make a lot of sense in light of the fact that you find it so difficult to find a racial bias among children, which I think is sort of a given. We've always known that. But I wonder what you think about this in terms of the class context.
I think that's, yeah, no, absolutely. And that's absolutely right.
This is Dr. Terwalter.
This is. yeah, no, so I think you're absolutely right. I think social class is surely entangled in this in ways that are really hard to tease apart in research. But we have looked a little bit at this question, and I'll tell you how. So one of the things that we've done is we've tried really hard to see if, at least experimentally, in lab studies, we can reduce this bias. And so far, it's been very easy to document the bias. It's been very easy to find it. It's been very hard to reduce it. The really one of the only studies where we've gotten people to recognize that Black and white people might actually feel the same pain is to give either the Black person that people are answering questions about, to give him or her a lot of status, a lot of power, which I think kind of goes in hand with what we think of social class, and to give the white person that they're rating very little power and very little status. And so I think you're absolutely right. I think social class very likely plays a role in this, and race might actually be serving as a proxy for that, for hardship and for social class. Because like I said, the only way so far we've really reduced the bias is by giving the Black person that people are answering questions about a lot of power, a lot of status, and the white person, very little status and power.
Jason, thanks so much for your question. Rebecca, I want to go back to you because you also mentioned this hardship scenario that the guess is maybe playing a role here in why people think that Blacks are tougher than whites. But you say that you find this predominant among 10-year-olds and even showing up to some degree on the part of 7-year-olds. Do we really have children that young adopting these kinds of cultural mythologies?
Yeah, I think that's the question that we're trying to investigate in the second study that we're doing right now. So we do see this bias beginning to develop at 7 and being really strong by age 10. And so what we're looking at is whether perceptions of hardship could explain that the development of that bias. So it might be the case that the 5-year-olds in our initial study don't show these differences. They don't think that different racial groups experience different levels of hardship, but that by age 7 and certainly by age 10, children are starting to experience more about society, and maybe through the media, they're getting these sorts of perceptions, and that when they start to recognize or believe in these different racial groups in hardship, they start to show this racial bias and pain perception.
And if I may, just to clarify something else and relevant to what the previous caller just said, there is actually very, excuse me, good evidence that children and very young children have some amount of racial bias. It's not racial bias in the sense that they're really hating or disliking children from groups that aren't their own, but they have a very clear preference for children and people who are in their groups. And so even though it doesn't have this very negative kind of flavor, there is a good amount of kind of preference for one's own racial group at very, very early ages. So it's not actually true that children don't have racial bias. Even at age 5, children have some amount of racial bias. It just doesn't come through in the form that we've investigated.
Right. And in the data that we do have, you know, we do see that the 5-year-olds have this sort of, like I was saying before, social preference. So they do choose the children that are white to be their friends more often than the children that are Black. So they are recognizing race. They are showing these racial biases. They just don't show this particular one until a little bit later.
Social psychology researchers Rebecca Doerr, Kelly Hoffman, and Sophie Terwalter are our guests. Dr. Terwalter is a faculty member in the Department of Psychology at the University of Virginia. Ms. Hoffman and Ms. Doerr are both doctoral candidates at that school. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We've got some phone lines open if you want to talk with our guests. 888-WMRA. Talk is one way to remember our number. The other way, all numbers, 888-967-2825. Next to Harrisonburg, Danny, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
Hi, thank you. Very interesting topic to me. I'm a parent of an African-American boy, and So I'm wondering in the study if this was exclusively focused on physical pain and if you made any distinction or any correlations between emotional and psychological pain. I often think of you know, my son and younger kids of, you know, the darker your skin, almost the more you have to think they have need to develop thicker skin. And you know, parents, you know, training kids to have thick skin, you know, as it's darker. So I'm curious to hear if you had any research on that.
So this is Kelly. Thanks. Thank you for your question. And we have looked at emotional pain. So there is a large body of work in social psychology looking at the attribution of emotions to different racial groups and has found that people attribute complex emotions, things like grief or anguish or
pride,
less with racial outgroups, in particular Black people, relative to white people. And so we thought that perhaps this also extends to denying emotional pain to Black people as well. But we have not found evidence in our studies examining the extent to which people perceive others to feel emotional pain to show this racial bias in the same way.
Yeah, actually, interestingly, if anything, people seem to think that Black people feel more more emotional pain than white people, which I thought was interesting and not necessarily predicted. We focus on physical pain in part because our research is motivated by this desire to understand racial disparities in healthcare, where physical pain is obviously more germane. But yet, no, the question about whether a similar bias might operate for emotional pain is a really interesting one and an important one, but a different one.
Danny, I apologize. We had a little trouble with the telephone connection there, and there was a little dropout. Did you say that you are African-American yourself?
No. My son's African-American. I certainly, notice and try to keep an eye to biases that, we might be teaching him, biases he might be experiencing as well. So.
Does this idea that some people, African-American, white, Asian, Hispanic, would assume that your son is less likely to feel pain than a white child ring any bells for you or ring any alarms?
That's really hard to say. Certainly a question he gets all the time is, boy, you must be a great athlete.
Yeah.
We hear that all the time. Yeah. What sports are you involved in? You know, he's a musician. He hears this all the time. And he makes an immediate jump in his head of why that is.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
I would be a little reluctant to say I've kind of thought, noticed some distinction about whether folks think he has some different experience of physical pain, really.
Right. And that's what makes it so particularly problematic is that a lot of times, you know, it's hard if you just have you're in this context where it's just you and a doctor and there's nothing to compare it to. You know, how are you to know whether you're being perceived as feeling less pain than someone else? You don't have that relative comparison and you don't have this baseline for knowing what an adequate medication you should be because they're the professional and they're the one who's supposed to be recognizing your pain regardless of what you look like.
Danny, thank you so much for your call. We're going next to Charlottesville. Jane, thanks for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please, for social psychology researchers Kelly Hoffman, Rebecca Dorr, and or Sophie Trewalter.
Thank you. Your conversation is very interesting. I grew up in a small southern town, and as a little child, I was extremely sensitive to all children, whether they were Black or white. And I would have, you know, given them anything I had if I knew they needed it. I loved all of them. And I don't hear an echo of that in the type of questions that are the analysis of the questions. Children are compassionate about other children, generally, I think. And you have to take that into consideration as they're answering some of these questions. I knew that the Black children in our area were not wealthy. I had seen where most of them lived and compared it to where we lived and other people, and I understood that there were differences, and I hated those differences. Have you looked at the possibility of measuring that type of response from the children, or seeing if you can elicit that type of caring?
Right, that's really interesting. What we see overall here is a bias on average. So, of course, we're not saying that this necessarily means that children at the ages of 7 and 10 are all necessarily showing this bias in pain perception. But the other thing to mention is that this might not be perceived, like I think has been mentioned previously, as a negative bias, right? It might be seen as something that is sort of positive, that kids might be perceiving these children as tougher, that might be a good thing that they're perceiving, mm-hmm. not necessarily thinking of it as a negative bias. But it's an interesting question whether this is related to empathy or perspective taking. And we don't really know at this point, but that's definitely a possibility for future interventions, is thinking about whether trying to get children to take the perspective of children that look different than them and think about the pain and feel empathetic towards them would be related to reducing this bias.
Yeah, and a lot of
would certainly have gone, felt empathy toward them, even as much smaller than 7 earlier. And would have judged that, yes, they probably did feel hurt just as much as I did, and maybe more because they had a harder life. I knew that from
Sophie?
Seeing it.
I was going to mention with regards to empathy that we know that on average people empathize less with people who are not of their racial group versus people in their racial groups. And typically, the story or the explanation has been that people just don't care about people from other racial groups, and that's why they can't empathize. I think our data suggests that there might be something else going on in addition to that, and that is that it's not that people don't care about people in this other racial group. And in our case, it's not the case necessarily that white people don't care about Black people, and although that can be sometimes the case, but that also they might not recognize that there is pain there to recognize. And if what's driving this is really this notion that, oh, they've had such a hard life, they must be tougher than someone who hasn't had such a hard life, then it's easy to see how that empathy gap might happen without any ill intention. I think that's really important to remember, is that when these children or even when our adult participants are saying that they don't think this Black person feels as much pain as perhaps a white person would, that they're not, in their minds, they're not saying something that's hurtful or nasty or mean. It's meant often, I think, for some of our participants with very, very good intentions and trying to recognize, for them, trying to recognize that this person has likely had hardship and that confers some sort of strength, isn't meant from the participant's perspective as lacking compassion. Actually, I think very much to the contrary.
And Kelly Hoffman, the fact that African Americans are also rating that they believe people of their race feel pain less readily than whites speaks to this idea, this cultural mythology that we have in America, that Blacks are tougher than whites?
Right, because if it was something about an intergroup dynamic, so if it was the case that there was this empathy gap where a racial outgroup isn't, feeling as much pain, then we wouldn't expect Black people to rate other fellow in-group members, other Black people, as feeling less pain. We would expect them to rate white people as feeling less pain. But given that they also show the same bias, and given that for Black participants, we've shown this link between hardship and perceptions of pain, it seems to be consistent with this notion that this mythology, as you call it, that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Hardship leads to toughness and therefore less sensitivity to pain.
Jane, thank you so very much for your call. We're going to continue here on Virginia Insight in just a bit more than 1 minute. We're looking at some unusual aspects of bias and prejudice related to race. And we're open to pretty much any discussion about bias and prejudice related to race. But the researchers here in the studio today have been looking at how people perceive pain among whites and among Blacks. And what they found is that people of all races, and even at fairly young ages, tend to report that white people feel pain more easily than Black people. Social psychology researcher and co-author of this recent study, Kelly Hoffman, is one of our guests. Sitting next to her, social psychology researcher and co-author of a recent study into bias in children, Rebecca Doerr, and also with us, researcher and professor of psychology, Sophie Trewalter. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Sophie, it's my understanding that some of your early research and some areas where you continue to focus attention has to do with a perception of why people get an experience of stress, even high stress, when they're interacting with somebody who is outside of their own race.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Sure. So a lot of the work that I've done, both in grad school and then beyond, is looking at interracial interactions. And we know from a lot of studies, some of mine, but some of other folks' studies, is we know that interracial interactions tend to be more stressful than same-race interactions. And I think many people can probably relate to this. I think our explanation for a long time was that one reason that white Americans might be so stressed during interracial interactions is because they have negative racial attitudes. And for some Americans, surely that's true, and that can lead to stress during interracial interactions. Some of the work that I've done, however, has suggested that concerns about appearing prejudiced are actually perhaps even more potent sources of stress during interracial interactions. And so if you're a white American, you know that there's the possibility that a racial ethnic interaction partner might think that you're biased, and that this possibility is very stressful for you, especially if you, in fact, don't think of yourself as a prejudiced person. And that leads to all sorts of then anxious behaviors that unfortunately come off as pretty negative during an interracial interaction. And so there's this irony and really this, I think, this tragedy that happens, that people who are really concerned about appearing prejudiced, those who are concerned the most, often end up looking the worst during interracial interactions. Their behavior is just not very positive, and it's because they're so anxious. So they will close their body posture, they'll avert their eye gaze, they will fidget, they will lean back and away from their interaction partner. And all of those things send cues to their ethnic, racial, minority interactant partner. It sends cues that they are not just nervous, but perhaps negatively inclined. And so, and that's just then really, it makes for a bad interaction.
You are nodding your head.
I was just agreeing with everything she was saying. I mean, there's a lot of research and a lot of wonderful work done by Sophie showing that it is very unfortunate that it's the people who are most well-intentioned that tend to have the most uncomfortable interracial interactions. And she also has work showing that it even takes up a lot of resources because people are trying to regulate and trying to make sure that they have a good interaction. And if they're not given the tools to do so, then it is a very, very stressful thing. And people leave these interactions not feeling good about the experience. And, you know, long-term consequences of that is maybe just avoiding these types of interactions altogether.
And going back to development as well, there's some other research, I believe, suggesting that kids will pick up on these interactions in their parents, so that if they'll see their parents interacting in these ways with members of racial groups, that they'll pick up on that, and actually leads to some negative racial attitudes in children as well. Maybe Sophie can mm-hmm. speak to that a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're also, or at least in the lab, we found that they're very easy ways to actually have better interracial interactions. In one study, we've asked participants to go into these interactions either with the mindset that they shouldn't appear prejudiced and that they should try not to do anything wrong. And as you might expect, that is not a good strategy and really trips people up. In another condition in the study, we've asked people to think about this as an opportunity for a positive inter-ethnic interaction and to try to do things right. And even though those two things sound very similar, right, not doing wrong versus doing right, they lead to very different outcomes. So people who go into an interracial interaction with the mindset that they're going to try to be egalitarian, they're going to try to do the right thing, they have much more positive interracial interactions compared to people who go in thinking, okay, don't say the wrong thing, don't do the wrong thing, don't be prejudiced. And so I think just that very subtle shift in mindset can actually go a long ways in in making for more positive interracial interactions.
Kelly Hoffman, is there some driving force in your life that helps generate why you are so interested in this type of research?
Yes, actually, there is. Kind of similar to Sophie, except in the United States and not France. I grew up in a very small rural town that was not very diverse, and I went off to college and just, like Sophie, was just thrown in my face all this wonderful diversity, and it was just something that I had never been thinking about and I never was forced to think about because, you know, for me growing up, it was just white is what there is. And yes, there were this outside world, but it just wasn't relevant to my life until I got to college. And I just became really interested in diversity and in particularly discrimination and prejudice because I wanted to better understand how some of the attitudes of those that I grew up around manifest. And for me, it was really trying to reconcile this notion that the people that I grew up with and that I care about and love might hold these really negative attitudes. And, you know, to me, that was striking because I always just assumed that racist people were these really evil KKK members or just these really extremes. From a lot of research, we know that everyone holds bias of some sort and manifests in very different ways and has.
So would it be accurate to say that there are people who you otherwise knew as sweet, loving people that you grew up around that today you would say they are quite racist in their attitudes towards blacks or other minorities?
Yes, and I think this
and
is.
And have you come to some conclusion or some guesses about why such people hold such racist prejudices?
I mean, we have a long history of black-white intergroup tensions. And I think, you know, when you're in these areas where you're just surrounded by members of your own group and you're not having experience with other out-group members, you know, that's when all these prejudices and biases can kind of emerge and you don't have contact to get things that kind of disconfirm any types of stereotypes or any things that you imagine would happen if you came into contact with members of these groups. And so,
Kelly, is it okay for me to reveal the part of the country where you grew up?
Sure.
Because I've spent some time as a reporter and an interviewer in that part of the world, and it was rural central Pennsylvania. And when I first moved there back in the mid-90s, I was struck by what I felt seemed to me to be very racist attitudes on the part of the overwhelmingly white populations of that part of the world. And yet, these struck me as otherwise very caring, sensitive people. And I puzzled over this for a long time because those seemed to not go together in my mind. And the conclusion, or at least the guesses that I came to, was that there was a lot of fear going on.
Mm-hmm.
Fear of the unknown, fear of interacting with people who seemed to come from a different way of thinking or a different way of being just because their skin color is different. So I'm curious, since I've got the three of you social psychology researchers here, if you think that that is at all a valid hypothesis?
Oh, of course. Yeah, no. And so I was going to say, well, developmentally, and Rebecca can speak to this a little bit more, but it's clear that bias starts as an in-group preference, right? You prefer your group. And by virtue of preferring your group, you don't like other groups as much. That bias can evolve and you can over time learn to actually dislike the other group, not just to prefer your own group. And things like threat, right? So threat to resources, threat to status can really, really exacerbate
but
that bias.
But it's often imagined.
It's often or symbolic. I wouldn't say imagined because, you know, it's I think people don't think it's imagined and it feels very real
And
yeah,
I think
fear may feel very real, but it may. Yeah, one of the things that I facilitated as an interviewer was trying to get African Americans and whites talking to each other. And what I heard so frequently from both sides was, I had no idea that you people were like that. In other words, my fear has gone down significantly here. And what it seemed to me that I was experiencing was people finding that their fears were unfounded.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think of it as imagined fear, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, and I think that's right. So one of the reasons, and Rebecca, I think, mentioned this earlier, one of the surest ways to decrease bias is to have intergroup contact, right? And there are some boundary conditions to that. So the contact should be of equal status. It should be more or less positive. It should be sustained over time. But what we know, and really the only thing that we know for sure reduces bias in this kind of long-term way is contact. And I think one reason that's true is because it gives you the opportunity to disconfirm negative stereotypes. And like you said, to the extent that this other group seems really unfamiliar and kind of scary, it can reduce that lack of familiarity.
Yeah, we also know that developmentally, a lot of what's happening as children's bias decreases across childhood is they're both increasing in their positive views about outgroups, but also increasing in their negative views about in-groups, right? So it's definitely this in-group bias going down and this out-group bias becoming more positive. And both of those things are happening. It also seems to be related to recognizing both within group differences, so people within the same group can be different from each other, and a decrease in the view that everybody in that out group is very similar to each other.
Yeah, I mean, I think another important component here is that attitudes are actually not always really good predictors of behavior. And so to the extent that we really care about intergroup discrimination and not so much prejudice, I think there are other ways that we can ensure that discrimination doesn't happen in spite of what might be some negative racial attitudes. And one of the things we know from research is that social norms are incredibly powerful. So if the norm in a community is that discrimination is not okay, even if you have people with some negative racial attitudes, I think that social norm is going to win out. And so I think often when we get questions about, well, how do you reduce prejudice? It's with the intent of reducing discrimination. And I think that actually a better way to reduce discrimination might be through social norms and not so much through prejudice reduction, just because attitudes are so difficult to change, and racial attitudes in particular.
Well, Rebecca Dora is someone who's been working with children's attitudes and with children. It seems to me that, Rebecca, that there are a lot of people in our country today who are operating on the theory that this is going to continue to get better because young people have less and less prejudice. I'm curious if you hold that hope.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it speaks to a lot of what Sophie's saying about social norms, right? I think the social norms in society are definitely changing over time. But what we see developmentally is that, you know, even now, children do have negative racial attitudes from very young ages. So there are, you know, these in-group preferences and these social preferences for, you know, pro-white social preferences by age 5. So we know that those attitudes are held even in 2014.
Yeah, and I think an important note to make about racial attitudes in general is that just because they seem to be getting it better doesn't mean that they're actually going away. It just might mean that they're changing form. So when we talk about racism, you know, of the past, you know, that's when and what you were talking about your experience in Pennsylvania, are these like very overt negative things. And that's why it seems so surprising, because now the norm is that that's not okay to do that. But that doesn't mean that there still isn't negative racial attitudes in other ways. And like I talked about earlier about these implicit racial attitudes and preferences for in-group over out-group. It just means that they're changing forms and they're less acceptable to be explicitly stated, but it doesn't mean that they're gone.
Well, Sophie Trier-Walter, we're almost out of time. We've got less than a minute, but I'm sure there are parents listening who may be saying to themselves, I'm not sure how much I can change the social norms in my community or what's acceptable in my community,
That's true.
I sure would like to encourage my children to have less prejudice, to be as open towards all people as possible. You have any recommendations for such parents?
Oh, that's so hard. And maybe Rebecca can also give some advice.
Well, we got 30 seconds. So.
I would say don't ignore race. You should talk
to your child about race if you think it's an important thing for him or her to know. Because being colorblind, pretending like race isn't a factor and that it doesn't exist, doesn't seem to be helping racial attitudes.
15 seconds to you, Rebecca.
The other thing that we've mentioned previously is contact, right? So increasing the amount of contact seems to be helpful that children have with members of other racial groups, given that contact is equitable and mostly positive.
Our guests have been from the University of Virginia social psychology researchers Rebecca Dorr and Kelly Marie Hoffman, plus their faculty mentor at UVA's Department of Psychology, Dr. Sophie Trewalter. Thank you also very much for making time for us.
Thanks for having us.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Dan Easley, Terry Ward, and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jaspe and Inner Rhythm. Recordings of previous Virginia Insight broadcasts are available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. And when you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will find links to more information about all of our guests and the work they are doing. And if you go to the Virginia Insight Facebook page and click like, you'll get access to a whole bunch more information about these broadcasts there as well. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.